leaseholders are being ripped off by developers, freeholders, and let's not forget, management agents, while social housing is in decline. On top of that, many leasehold properties are being deemed worthless because of cladding that makes them deemed unsafe. Also, the recent Household Reform Act passed in Parliament does not genuinely protect leaseholders, or does it? Now we have a new government with majority. What would that do to make changes for leaseholders, or is it just another government that is going to come and go? Welcome to Debt Talk Podcast with me, your host, Ripon Ray. This time, I'm going to speak about another important subject, leaseholders and charges, post-election setting under a new government. Before we speak about the topic, let me introduce you to my panel members. I have Sue Muna from Social Housing Action Campaign. She is a social housing campaigner. I also have Nicholas Kissen, Senior Advisor and a solicitor at the Leasehold Advisory Service, who advises leaseholders on issues leading to service charge complications and no doubt many more other issues. And finally, Matthew Connell, Director of Policy and Public Affairs for the Personal Finance Society, a professional body dedicated to building trust in the financial market. Many of its members advise on mortgages and no doubt leasehold and insurance-related matters. My panel members are also to provide top tips to listeners post-general election for those who are genuinely looking at getting leasehold charges on the agenda to the new Labour government. So let me start with Sue Muna from Social Housing Action Campaign to get a clear picture about current housing sector from a campaigner's perspective. Sue, tell us what is wrong with the current housing sector and most importantly, the leasehold sector.
Thank you, and really pleased to be on your podcast. Thank you for inviting us on. It's brilliant to be able to meet with others and connect with other people as well. I think what we would say is wrong with leasehold is that that system really shouldn't exist. It's a very exploitative system with the power really very firmly tilted in favor of the landlords, whoever the landlord is. So we see the same kind of problems cropping up whether people are in have a private freeholder or whether it's a council or whether it's a housing association. We see the same problems. And one of the biggest problems is this issue about service charges. But that really sort of cuts into a lot of other areas. For example, a lack of control over who provides the services, the communal services in the building. And we've seen this, for example, with heating systems being installed or energy providers that are providing, where it's really, really expensive. Or, contracts for cleaning that aren't done properly. And really, the leaseholders have very, very little say over who provides the services. So that really, is something that we would like to see. But also, there's a huge problem with service charge abuse, which is overcharging for services. Sometimes the services are non-existent. Sometimes they haven't been provided to the standards that is being claimed. Sometimes the service charge rises are just extortionate and unexplained. So there's a huge range of problems. I think it is a really problematic area, and not one that I can see is maybe going to change that much. We haven't seen a lot by way of promises for change.
You may want more social housing, however, the trend is going towards its opposite, because the demand for leasehold properties are rocketing up. Why do you think that is the case?
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. And I think what we saw, I mean, we Shaq did an analysis of four of the major party manifestos before the election. And what we saw largely from both the Conservatives and the Labour Party was an absolute obsession with pushing people onto the home ownership, property ownership ladder. And that isn't necessarily what people want. It's just the only way that people really feel that they can have any kind of control over their housing. So, people are pushed into that by their circumstances. We don't see the same level of obsession with home ownership in, for example, other European countries, but that's because the rights of tenants are much greater, so people can feel that they have a level of security living in a rented property that I think people in Britain just absolutely don't feel. And of course, the rented sector, the costs are going up massively as well. So people find themselves maybe paying as much or more in their rental every month than maybe someone they know who's been able to get together a deposit and is paying a mortgage, even quite high mortgage, sometimes is still cheaper than the rented sector. So the two sectors are very closely intertwined, aren't they? What happens in one sector is going to happen, is going to impact on the pattern in the other sector.
Now, your interest lies in social housing. What I've noticed is that even those who are living in social housing these days can't afford to even pay their rent. Doesn't that make a mockery of the social housing as well? And of course, social landlords.
Yeah, it does. It does. We are losing the cheapest or one of or sort of the biggest form of social sort of rent. The cheapest form of social rent is social renting, which is 50% of market rates. But that obviously can still be quite high in areas where the rents in the private sector are quite high. Then you will find that the social rents in that area are also going to be very high. But we are losing social rent tenancies by the thousands every year. I mean, over the last 10 years, we've lost something like 210,000 social rent tenancies. And quite often, these are being converted to what is called affordable rents. And affordable just means anything up to 80% of the full market rate. And of course, a subsidy of 20% is just not great enough when we're talking about rents at the level that we've got. Where Shaq concentrates is on campaigning really mainly around housing associations. So that can be social renters, affordable renters, but also a lot of leaseholders, their freeholder is a housing association. And obviously they are very heavily pushing the shared ownership model as well, which is more or less the same thing. It's kind of half rent, half buy. So you will be a leaseholder as well if you are in the shared ownership sort of type of tenancy really arrangement with your landlord. So housing associations really now provide a huge different range of housing products, if you like, as they like to call them, which can include leaseholders and shared owners.
You mentioned housing associations and you're pushing on that subject. Now, I'm not sure if you had the opportunity to follow a story in East End of London in Hackney where a social landlord selling its assets because to maintain old buildings are just too much. So sell them. So doesn't that also make it complicated for your campaign whereby you want social landlords, but social landlords are not really that interested in taking on properties that are high maintenance. Where does that leave concept of, social housing?
Well, we would argue that it's a real false economy not to invest in housing. Housing, you can look at the cost as an upfront cost and being quite expensive, because it is quite expensive to build a house, to develop a house, to maintain a house is quite expensive. But there is a huge knock-on cost if we don't do that. So, for example, the NHS, I think the figure given, I was reading one of the House of Commons papers, I think it was something like 2.4 billion every year, a cost to the NHS of treating patients who have suffered from illnesses or injury as a result of bad housing. So that isn't an immediate cost. That doesn't appear in the kind of, profit and loss calculations when councils are looking at that or when government is looking at it. But that cost is not is still there. It's still creating a cost to society and a cost to the public purse when we don't properly invest in decent, affordable housing. So it's really about where do we want to make the investment, and government needs to be investing really in council housing as the most democratic form. It's not ideal and certainly not perfect, and we have plenty of council members, who are tenants and residents of councils, who are also experiencing a lot of problems for the same reasons. But there is a level of democracy and accountability there that just isn't there with housing associations. They're not public bodies. They don't have to be accountable to anybody really, except their city investors. So the financial model is a really big question, and we would like to see far more done to actually sort of get to grips with that really.
So, what is your take on the recent Act of Parliament that have went through?
I don't think the Leasehold Reform Bill, I mean, it's already been watered down multiple times, hasn't it, as it's sort of gone through. And I don't see that it's really going to make a massive difference. I mean, there's still 5 years or something like that for landlords, to carry on creaming off people before we end up with sort of what are supposed to be peppercorn rents. The landlord lobby is extremely powerful, and I'm sure that over that time they will be lobbying harder and harder to make sure that, they keep as much of what they've got already as possible. So I think that really needs to be looked at. I don't think it is going to offer significant protections, and I think in a lot of areas and a lot of the problems experienced by leaseholders, there's absolutely no justification for why the law should be different for leaseholders than it is for tenants, except really that it divides people and it sets one group against another. And what we would like to see is a lot of the rights just being shared by everybody. For example, leaseholders have a legal entitlement to see their invoices for their charges. It's very hard to enforce that, by the way. It's almost impossible to enforce it, but at least that legal right is there. What's the justification for saying that tenants shouldn't have that legal right? It's just really about dividing different groups of people, setting one group against another, and distracting from the main argument, which is really this, as we said at the beginning, very big power imbalance between the landlords and the tenants and residents who are living in their properties.
We now have a new Labour government, and do you think the government would make any difference or make it easier for leaseholders or, in your case, social tenants?
Our members include leaseholders as well, as I said, where they are leasing from a housing association, which is quite a big portion of the bigger housing association's work now. I don't think so. I think there's lots of things that there wasn't really anything in the manifesto that gave me the confidence that that was going to change. So I think there's a lot more that we will need to be discussing with them alongside lots of other groups, campaign groups, individuals who are really trying to highlight problems within the housing crisis. We work in coalition with them, and I'm sure we will be approaching the government really to step up its program of protections to rebalance so that there is a much fairer balance between the landlord and the tenant. And ultimately, what we would like to see is a complete kind of democratization of housing, so that it is properly under the control of the people who live in those homes, whether it's in a block of flats, whether it's in a street property, whether it's part of, hostel accommodation. Really, people should have far greater protections and far greater rights and be able to enforce those.
Let me get Nicholas Kisson from the Leasehold Advisory Service into the conversation. Nicholas, based on what you've heard from Suze, what is your initial thought?
So a few points I've picked up from what Suze was saying. One is about leaseholders having little say on who provides their cleaning and other services. That's a fair point. I mean, it's a reactive relationship. The work's done and then you build. I mean, in certain circumstances, there can be consultation before contracts for works or services are placed. But otherwise, unless leaseholders are in the driving seat in terms of actually being responsible for the management of a building or being the actual freeholders stroke landlords, yeah, they are basically reacting. Also, problems with service charge abuses. I mean, that's a significant area of what we advise upon. I mean, a lot of inquiries each month, and we keep data as well, all confidential when people ring us up. But yeah, high service charges, are they justified? What rights do I have? Where can I go to challenge service charges if I feel that I'm being abused, they're not right, etc. If I don't feel I'm being treated properly by my property manager, what can I do? Where can I go? What short-term or what long-term remedies do I have? So yes, that's my initial view on what Suze has said. I can't really comment, being a neutral body, about Social and government policy about home ownership. One all has one's thoughts on it. There are struggles, being tenant or being a homeowner. Hopefully one goes towards a better world and that everybody will live in safety and security and happy in whatever type of tenure that they're living in.
There are several leaseholders stuck in their property. In fact,
correct.
Their property is literally unsellable because of cladding attached. What that actually means for leaseholders?
I mean, there's the mental distress if you've got combustible cladding and also non-cladding combustibility or fire safety issues. There's that mental distress, but there's also the financial concern in terms of thinking of the property builders, the property owners, the property managers, if they want to remove and replace the cladding, and that might be a lengthy process. Am I going to be stuck with the bills? In fact, where I live in North Hertfordshire, there's a block down my road in Stevenage that's been in the papers, Vistry Tower, where the Secretary of State had to use certain powers going to a property tribunal to force the pace of remediation and get an order about it. Yes, bills for cladding and removal and remediation, if the costs are recoverable through the service charges, that is a problem for leaseholders. But to a certain extent, there are rights that they have. And the Building Safety Act 2022, it wasn't in the original legislation, but added as amendments whilst it was going through Parliament and eventually ended up in the eventual Act for protection against cladding. If the leaseholders have a qualifying lease, what's called a qualifying lease. And the main type of person's got a qualifying lease is somebody who lives there as their only or principal home. There are others as well who have qualifying leases. If they've got there as their only or principal home, and if they got a long lease, one granted for over 21 years, they're paying service charges under it, and it was granted before the 14th of February 2022, then if they've got a qualifying lease, they have protection in the Building Safety Act 2022 from paying towards the costs of the removal and replacement of cladding. Likewise, even if they don't have a qualifying lease, if the landlord, as at the 14th of February 2022, was responsible for the cladding defect, what we call a relevant defect, the cladding defect, or associated with an entity, usually a company that was responsible for it, then even if they don't have a qualifying lease, they don't have to pay towards the cladding removal and replacement. There are also funding streams that government has. There's schemes for over 18 metres, height of the building, and between 11 and 18 metres, funding schemes. There's a process that building managers have to go through in accessing that funding, but it's there. Likewise, if the original developer, I think it's 49 of like the major developers, signed what's called the developer's pledge, that's now been translated into what's called a self-remediating contract. If the building, in respect to certain of their buildings, they've pledged that they will remediate historic fire safety related matters, such that hopefully the costs of doing so aren't visited upon the leaseholders through the service charges.
And knowing that the cost of living, no doubt, has pinched a lot of leaseholders and pinched their pockets. So in terms of patterns that you have seen within the context of giving advice, what sort of patterns have you seen due to rising cost of living crisis, and who has been seeking advice from you guys?
So, I mean, we had just over 900 last April on service charge inquiries. And the following month, May, we had just over 700. And in June, sort of around about 670 inquiries just about service charges. I haven't had time to drill down, but there'll usually be, I think it's too high, how do I challenge it? Or I don't think I've been consulted, because there is a process for consultation, statutory consultation for so-called major works, that sort of thing. Or I've been billed for, where do I go to challenge these bills? Can either be the county court or a body called the First Tier Tribunal Property Chamber, which you may have come across. We've got literature galore and FAQs and podcasts and webinars about this, as well as our telephone advice service. But if you can make out a persuasive case, that the costs, if the costs, the service charges, which might be for a roof replacement, it might be for external decorations, it might be for cleaning, might be for caretaking, it might be for building insurance, if you can make out a case that it's not reasonable, it's not justifiable, if you can make out a persuasive case, hopefully you can resolve it with the building property managers, and we regard litigation as a last resort, try and resolve it. It's a headache in terms of time and cost to go to litigation. But ultimately, if you do end up at a court or usually a property tribunal, you've do got the rights to challenge them. And tribunal decisions are, you know, if it goes to a hearing and there's a decision, property tribunal decisions are matters of public record. The government does publish them. We've got some on our website as well. They're not binding. Upper tribunal decisions, appeal forum, are binding. They're court. They're like the. They've got the same authority as a court, but the first tier tribunal decisions, like employment tribunal decisions, that they're well worth reading. They're well worth reading, particularly if it's the same landlord as your own, particularly if it's the same managing agent as your own. They're well worth reading. They'll give you a flavour of the sort of evidence that's heard, the sort of arguments that are deployed, the sort of thinking that the tribunal panel members engage in.
How does leaseholder and shared ownership differ, and what actually happens to shared ownership? I know Suze mentioned it briefly earlier in terms of shared ownership, paying service charge and or rent, because obviously there's 50-50, isn't it? Tell us more about that.
Well, the rent's different because the rent is based on a percentage of market rent. In terms of service charges, the rights are the same. You're paying service charges to the extent of the area, the percentage that you own, which might be 25%, 50%. But the rights you have are the same in terms of service charges, in terms of challenging service charges. When it comes to shared ownership, yeah, you do have rights to challenge said service charges under shared ownership leases.
What does leasehold advisory service want to see happen from the next government to protect leaseholders from extortionate increase?
There's stuff in the Leasehold and Freehold Reform Act 2024 that came, you know, that was passed towards the fag end of the last parliamentary session, about service charges and service charge rights and enhancing them, and a model prescribed form of service charge demand and of accounts and the deadline to provide them, and transparency issues. And also there's an interesting one that some freehold houses, which may not be your audience, but they also pay service charges sometimes for the upkeep of an estate. They're given rights as well, freehold houses.
Thank you, Nicholas, from Leasehold Advisory Service. Let me move on to Matt Connell, Director of Policy and Public Affairs for the Personal Finance Society, which is the professional body. What is your take on the current legislation by the government? Does that meet the need of leaseholders, or do you think it has been watered down?
It's not just the legislation, there's also, it feeds into regulation. And so that's really, the legislation is really just the first step on the path. I think to take up a point that Sue's made that's really important is around equal treatment of leaseholders in relation to people with other forms of housing, and particularly, I guess one good piece of news is on the financial services side. Obviously, insurance costs can be a substantial element of service costs. Before the election, new regulations were brought in by the Financial Conduct Authority. So that was a classic example of how leaseholders have been treated differently without anyone really kind of coming to terms with it or realizing it, because for most people, as customers of buildings and contents insurance, of home insurance, they're the customer and they enjoy a lot of rights as consumers under regulation. That didn't apply to a lot of leaseholders, because in that situation, the landlord was treated as the customer buying the insurance, and the leaseholder didn't really figure in the regulator's definition of a customer, and the regulators are changing that and creating a new sort of form of stakeholder that enjoys the same kind of rights as consumers, the rights to, you know, complain under financial services rules that puts more responsibility on insurance brokers and insurance companies to think of the leaseholder as the customer as well as the landlord, which most brokers and insurers were doing, but obviously, you know, you need regulation to make sure that everyone's enjoying those rights. So I think that's an ongoing process, just really understanding all the arcane elements of the law around leaseholders, and really systematically working through and asking not just is there a legal right for leaseholders to have the same treatment as people in other forms of housing, but actually making sure that that's working on the ground. And I think that's a big element. So some of the work that we're doing as a professional body with the regulator is understanding how, for example, financial services firms kind of monitor what's happening in terms of the sort of end outcomes for leaseholders in terms of value for money, and in terms of the service they're getting, in terms of the quality of the coverage they're getting, and really giving guidance to professionals and firms to make sure that they're doing everything that they need to do, not just to follow the rules, but to make sure that the right outcomes are being delivered for leaseholders.
And we are a nation where home owning is encouraged while renting is so high. There's been also a huge change in the property sector. How is the buying and selling leasehold property is looking like in the market?
It is very difficult, and I think we've touched on some of the points already. On a personal level, my niece has a leasehold flat that she's been selling, and one dimension of that is the kind of issues around the documentation that mortgage holders what need for various different buildings that have different status under the regulations around cladding, and that can be very difficult. And in the end, she's chosen to rent out her flat and purchase a house somewhere else because simply those issues around buying and selling are still so fraught. She's giving herself a few years to go through that process and buying a house while renting. So I guess it is difficult. Not everyone has the same options in front of them. So what I really encourage people to do is obviously there's free money advice out there, government funded, in terms of things like Money Helper. They're set up to help leaseholders and renters. Obviously there's places that can help, and you know, Nicholas's organisation Lease, that's a really good one to go to. And I guess the other element in terms of buying and selling is you know, you can get lots of free guidance, but also if you go to a professional advisor like a mortgage broker, they're people who are regulated and have to achieve certain levels of competence, but you know, it's compulsory but by regulation, and so seeing a professional about, you know, kind of arranging mortgages, to explain the different types of ownership and to signpost to other professionals, that's a really valuable route. No professional is services are free, but it can be a really good investment to get professional advice around things like choosing the mortgage and going through that process.
You briefly covered about insurance. I mean, where does insurance actually fit in with leasehold? Let's expand on that a bit more.
With leaseholding, often it's the landlord or the managing agent for the landlord that arranges the insurance, and so often they'll hire a broker, and the broker recommends an insurance product, and up until very recently, the regulation was focused really around the relationship between the broker and the landlord, but didn't necessarily bring in the leaseholder. So if leaseholders did have recourse in terms of tribunals set up under housing legislation, but those perhaps weren't as user friendly as the recourse that leaseholders can get through financial services regulation, which are very accessible and are set up really to be a very easy and informal you know, free option for people who have complaints. And again, you know, going back to the point that Sue's made, the regulation around leaseholders has been changed, so that leaseholders can have much more transparency around how much they're paying for insurance, and what that insurance covers. So again, they're being treated more like customers now, who have a right to that information, rather than people who are sort of under the care of the landlord, and then it was up to the landlord to decide how much information that they saw.
Only a few years ago, the market was booming with a variety of products linked with mortgages. Where are we now with leasehold mortgage products?
It has been obviously a very volatile market, with uncertainty around interest rates, and then further uncertainty around sort of cladding issues. And then I think Nicholas mentioned that often once people start digging into the cladding issues, there might be other issues around the building that aren't related to cladding. But once you have a safety engineer looking at the cladding, then other issues come to light. It is a case that mortgage providers have become more aware of the different risks and have become more demanding about the information that they'd like to see. And again, you know, representing a professional body that includes qualified mortgage brokers, I think, you know, that one value add that mortgage brokers can really bring is to kind of sift through different mortgage different lenders' demands for information and look across the market and try and look at what's the most appropriate for each leaseholder in terms of what kind of products are out there and how to adapt to the changing market.
You talked about different products that are out there. Can you give more meat in the diverse range of products related to mortgages?
First of all, there's the kind of different mortgage providers will have different sort of target markets. So some of them will specialize in sort of assessing leaseholder risks. And so those kind of contracts might be a bit more flexible, a bit more tailored to the needs of leaseholders. Other mortgage lenders might not have that as a target market. And so they might be perhaps more demanding or have more generic requirements for information and for evidence around the risks, and then of course in terms of the mortgage products themselves, it's kind of not just the interest rate but the kind of how long it's fixed for and what kind of fixed rate is appropriate for different people with different circumstances, and there's been a lot of volatility around kind of what kind of fixed rates are available to all borrowers over what term and at what rate, and again talking to a mortgage broker, you know, several months before you actually buy, can put you in a really strong position in terms of understanding what's out there and how that's tailored to you.
How does the mortgage sector actually work within the context of lenders work?
It's basically every mortgage is a contract. So every mortgage can be subtly different. And I guess for a lot of people it's the availability of the mortgage, but then it's going through the application process, because different buildings obviously have different status of regulation, and will need different kind of certification to reassure the mortgage lender that, you know, that the cladding is for example is in good shape, but equally, you know, there are other safety elements that obviously a lot of mortgage lenders, if a building doesn't attain a certain level of safety, then the mortgage lender simply won't lend for that kind of property, and you know, again, that can change while people are living in properties. And again, you know, no personal experience of people who've lived in one block of flats and it had a very small amount of cladding, and they thought that's not a problem. The safety engineer came in and found that the fire safety between different floors in the building hadn't been implemented properly, and so a fire could spread very quickly from one floor to a higher floor in the building, which again made it pretty much impossible to take out a mortgage on apartments in that building. So now the only people who move in are either renters who kind of aware of the risks but happy to rent, or else sort of cash buyers who don't need to go to a mortgage lender because those safety issues in particular are ones that mortgage lenders will be quite demanding about, seeing the right kind of evidence that those risks have been assessed by a professional and that won't impair people's or impair the value of the property if the mortgage lender needs to rely on that as collateral to pay off the mortgage.
Your organization is about making sure regulated professionals, such as financial planners, are equipped with knowledge to make sure they provide quality service to British people. What
Absolutely.
has been your members saying about the changes and the dynamics within the context of leasehold service charges?
So we've got members both on the financial planning side and the mortgage side, but also on the insurance side. And actually, I think the vast majority, pretty much all the professionals that we've spoken to, really welcome the fact that this issue has come under scrutiny, and that regulation has come in. Basically, the regulation gives more clarity, but also for people working in this area. When standards are improved, when there's more transparency, when there's really clear duty of care and clarity around how people should be handling conflicts of interest, the people who are doing the right thing already are very reassured by that, because they then don't have to compete against a small minority of people who are using the loopholes in the law to not give the right kind of outcomes to customers. But equally, one feedback that we get very frequently, particularly on the insurance side, is just how many issues and problems there are with the housing stock in the UK. That you know, kind of beneath the skin of a building, you don't really know what's going on until sometimes you just physically remove parts of it and look at it. And so I think there is, you know, this isn't an issue that's going to go away quickly, because as corrective action is taken, that uncovers more issues that requires more corrective action. And so I think, again, you know, an acknowledgement this is a really serious issue and not one that's just going to be solved overnight.
FCA recently implemented consumer duty principles.
Yes.
Now, how does that fit in with service charges?
In the past, because of that technicality, that leaseholders weren't counted as customers under sort of regulatory definitions, the consumer duty wouldn't have applied. But now, because of this new definition of leaseholders as stakeholders in the plan, the consumer duty does apply, and that's really important, because the basic requirement of the consumer duty is that firms sort of monitor the outcomes for clients, so measure what the outcomes are for customers, that they analyze what outcomes are taking place in the real world, you know, kind of based on customer experience and what they observe for customers, and then that firms take action to improve the product and the service, to provide a fair value, to provide the right kind of customer understanding, and to provide the right kind of service to customers, and so there's a new dialogue going on between brokers and insurers on the one hand, and also mortgage providers and mortgage brokers and the regulator, where the regulator say, well, show us the evidence that you've done this research, that you really understand what things look like from the customer point of view. Show us the evidence that you've had a discussion at board level about this, and show us the evidence that you've changed things that need to be changed, in terms of the way you supply the product, where you design the product and supply the service. So the changes that are made really are making a difference in terms of the way professionals operate and think on a day-to-day basis, not just sort of putting in some requirements for a new piece of regulation, and then once it's bedded down, sort of forget about it and move on to the next thing.
Thank you, Matt. For those who are listening to Debt Talk and want to share your experience on Debt Talk, you can get in touch with me on formerly Twitter, Your Dr. Debt, or email me ripon.ray@yourdrdebt.com. Now, let me go back to my panel members to speak about the top tips that they are going to give so the new government could explore ways to reduce indebtedness. But let me ask my panel members to find out, you know, what tips they would give. So let me start with Suze Mooner from Social Housing Action Campaign.
Our first one would be to abolish leaseholds. So this is something where we'd like to see. So it would be top of our list amongst a lot of other campaign groups. We'd like to see this equalisation of leaseholder, shared owner and tenants' rights. You know, obviously there will be some differences based on the different types of tenancies, but the rights should be the same. Allow people to legally withhold payment for disputed items. For example, if there are inaccurate service charges or service, you know, disrepairs that haven't been addressed, things like that. In Spain, I think it is, you are allowed, where you've got a disputed charge, you are allowed to pay the money to the court, and the court holds on to that money so that the landlord doesn't get it until they actually resolve the dispute, or, you know, the judge intervenes and will make a judgment on it. And I think that's a really good system, because at the moment, you are in law anyway, we support people to withhold payment, but in law, you are expected to pay even if you know a service has not been delivered. If you know you haven't got a lift, but they're charging you for lift maintenance, you're somehow still expected to pay. So we would like to see, that is such a scam. I mean, the idea of tenants and residents as kind of consumers is a nonsense, because you can't just change who your landlord is. You know, you can't just move your contract as you could with Vodafone or something. So we'd like to see, you know, really some way of not paying where the company, where your landlord is not delivering. Greater legal protections to end service charge abuse, amongst other things, and also to give people the a right democratically across a block to decide on their subcontractors. Because at the moment, as has been said, landlords have to consult, but they don't have to listen. There's no requirement on them to actually take any notice of what comes out of the consultation. And we'd like to increase access to justice, because having the law in place is only part of it. If you can't enforce that bit of legislation, if you can't enforce and access your rights, then it all just becomes a nonsense. And this is across all sectors, really. So we'd like to see legal aid for housing issues, quicker processes through the courts, and much tougher penalties and enforcement. You know, a fine of £250 or £500 might sound a lot to us as individuals, but when that's levied against a landlord that has got, as some of our housing associations do, surpluses in excess of, you know, £200 million, it doesn't make any difference. In fact, it can often be cheaper for them to pay the fine than actually, you know, comply with a court order to address or refund money that they've overcharged. So this whole system of enforcement is just not there, enforcement of the legal rights and access to justice. So I think we will be asking the new government to make some of these changes. And, you know, we will obviously be working, as I said, with other groups to do that as well.
Let me move on to Nicholas Kissen from Leasehold Advisory Service.
We're interested in seeing the timetable for implementing the rest of the Leasehold and Freehold Reform Act 2024. And any statutory instruments, secondary legislation. And two, I'd make the point, yes, we are funded by government. We have an interface with civil servants and the relevant government departments, principally the housing department, which may well be renamed for all we know. If any of your viewers, listeners have got suggestions, points they want to raise, they'd like us to take back to government, please drop us a line.
And finally, Matt Connell from Personal Finance Society.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, I guess the one thing I'd say is when you're exploring policy, make sure you've got everyone involved in the room. I think one of the most productive sessions we had when the cladding issue first came out, was a session with insurance professionals, trade associations, but also people who were in tenants associations and people representing landlords as well. Because I think with this issue, if you talk to people individually, you find out lots of problems, and then you talk to the next set of people, and they talk about all the barriers and issues, and if you ping pong between the two, then you end up with proposals often that get either watered down or that don't quite work for everyone. So I think a kind of approach to policy which is kind of based on workshops and which has leasehold tenants, and I think in particular, kind of members of tenants associations who often, that they've got huge responsibilities and not a huge amount of help or previous expertise. So they really can tell you exactly where the pinch points are and where the pain is, and if you can go from that to work through all the different professionals involved, and really understand where the blockages are, where there's kind of maybe gaps in responsibility, where things fall down. I think that approach to policy making, sort of really rigorous work-based approach, workshops approach, rather than perhaps a sort of traditional just publish a consultation and read what people send in. I think that's a really important element to it.
I want to again thank you for giving your precious time to this podcast on the subject matter, leaseholders and charges. My next podcast is going to be on carers and overpayment of benefits. Thank you for listening to Debt Talk podcast with me as your host, Ripon Ray.